Welcome once again to our final and 23rd session on the Da Vinci Code Deciphered. We've been talking about this famous novel that has been so popular in our country, made into a movie and then the DVD, and particularly in the last few weeks has had a lot of publicity again because the DVD is just coming out. My guest, as usual, who's done so much background research on the Da Vinci Code, is Ron Eldred, who teaches at John Paul II Catholic High. He is a teacher of government, American government, religion, history, world history, church history, and American history. And I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, pastor emeritus of St. Patrick Church here at 19th and Poplar in terrific Terre Haute. Ron, welcome once again. Thank you for your perseverance and your tremendous research for the program as we finish up now with our 23rd session. And obviously we've considered the need to do this because the Da Vinci Code has come to so many anti-history and particularly anti-Catholic conclusions under the guise of it's just a novel, so why get upset about it? But some 30, 40, or 50 million people have read it and said that they believe what it says in the front of the novel, that this has been historically deeply researched, and you can count on it as really authentic history. And in our conclusion, we've tried to say it's just rewriting history in so many circumstances. Well, Ron, once again, what are the reasons, you think, that the novel has been so appealing to so many people in this country, I think mostly, but into many other countries too?
We started to address that issue in the last session, but we ran out of time. So we'll repeat a couple of them that we talked about just in summary. One of them, and perhaps one of the most important, is the Gnostic aspect of the Da Vinci Code, which we explain in some detail, you know, during the series. And as I said, I don't think we can understand the Da Vinci Code without understanding what this Gnostic thing is.
And about hidden knowledge.
Yes, it's the idea of possessing hidden knowledge of the Gnostic type. It's very appealing to people because it makes them feel special and part of an elite. And then another reason is that there's a kind of an anti-authoritarianism in the novel. In fact, one critic has said that he believes that the main reason for the book's popularity is its I'll quote him here, fundamental suspicion of traditional claims to authority, where they conflict with contemporary ideas and standards, especially over sex and gender. Then one we didn't discuss, didn't have time to get into, would be individualism. The excessive individualism that runs rampant in the United States and Europe. Now, there's nothing wrong with individualism if it simply means the pursuit of personal happiness and independence or a belief in the importance of the individual, but it can be harmful if it unduly exalts the self at the expense of others and renounces all doctrine, dogma, and rules, as sometimes people who are, you know, extremely individualistic do. And there are other reasons. Deeper reasons. For example, I think the New Age orientation of the novel. You know, the New Age has been such a big thing in the past 25 or 30 years anyway. And in fact, EWTN ran a whole series on the New Age on both radio and TV, I believe.
And Father Mitch Pacwa had stated that he had been really involved as a Jesuit priest in the New Age and then began to see it in a fuller light, and he was the one who tried to discuss about why the New Age was approach was so dangerous.
Yes, in fact, he even written a book on the subject as well as video series that he put on. Well, I think during the past few decades, there's been a steadily growing interest in Gnostic and New Age ideas, as well as radical feminist notions that have undoubtedly contributed to the frenzied interest surrounding the Da Vinci Code. We won't go into the New Age because this is, EWTN has aired several programs on this and had a whole series on it, in fact, describing this phenomenon. And I think there are other reasons why the novel has been so successful. It has an anti-historical mentality. Many readers tacitly share Dan Brown's distrust of history. As one critic has said, many Americans are historically illiterate, and that the more ancient the history, the less regard they have for it. And why does he think this is so? Well, mostly because they believe, or at least act, as if though the world revolves around them. And he says, I believe correctly myself that those who have little regard for history are more willing to rewrite and revise it to suit their own ideological, spiritual, and emotional needs. And as we've quoted a radical feminist writer in an earlier session, actually we quoted her a couple of times, if one can't find the facts to prove one's point, then invent them. That's not the exact quote. I think we quoted the exact quote earlier in the series. But nonetheless, this mentality is made possible by the notion that there exists no reality outside the mind, so why not construct reality to satisfy one's own wishes, you know, one's own desires. If one believes that nothing is certain, then everything becomes just an opinion. One critic states that supporting this view, quote him, quote, internally confused outlook is the trendy conviction that truth can be reworked and remade in our own image. Truth is malleable. Truth is what works for me. Truth is what makes me feel good, end of quote. Another reason would be historical illiteracy. It's a little different than mentality. If there's no truth or reality outside the mind, then of what value is history? Because, you know, history is something that's in time and space, and it's something that actually really existed outside of our minds. It's something that's objective. You know, historical facts can be boring in themselves, but fiction, you know, can be made exciting. And because of this possibility, fiction found in books, television, or movies has become a primary source of historical information for many. As a consequence, most people learn their history from fictional sources such as, books like The Da Vinci Code and many, many others. It shouldn't surprise us that The Da Vinci Code was made into a movie. A lot of people get their history from movies and these documentaries we find on the History Channel and those type of channels. And some of the stuff is quite good. If you know your history fairly well, some of the programs you see are really quite good. But so many of them, the authorities that they call on and some of the views they put out are could be, you know, very misleading, extremely misleading.
So it is a fine way to learn history, reading good, solidly based historical novels.
Oh, yes, historical novels are fine. One of them I'm thinking of is Quo Vadis, for example. I think it tells a story about St. Peter in Rome and his final, of course,
crucifixion.
Crucifixion, yes, upside down. As one critic of the book and movie has said, quote, besides being an obvious moneymaker, its breezy style, sensationalism, and postmodern approach is perfectly suited for a society oriented toward amoral, lightweight, visual entertainment, end of quote. And he goes on to say, a pervasive relativism has paved the road for works such as The Da Vinci Code. Not only does Brown's novel rest on distrust of traditional avenues of history, religion, and truth, it harbors the notion that truth ultimately cannot be known, end of quote.
Okay, now I've talked to several highly educated people, even priests and the like, who said, I enjoyed it as a mystery thriller. And so I think we have to admit that it was a very interesting read, and if people can separate the wheat from the chaff and the fact from the fiction that's rewriting history, okay, it may not be harmful. But on the other hand, we know a lot of people have not done that and don't really have the background to do it, so they take it as really a fact, when so much of it is really just rewriting history.
I saw a series, or watched a series of programs on, I'm not sure which of the history channels, of those type channels, on Rome, and it was about 6-hour sessions. They were really quite good. The historical events that were portrayed there and discussed there, I thought were pretty accurate. They had one on Constantine, for example, I thought was quite good. One on Nero.
The Roman emperors.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I saw one the other night on Byzantium, and I thought that was quite good. I saw one a couple of weeks ago on the Vikings. I thought was excellent. We had just the week before discussed that with my world history class. And I thought, boy, that'd be really, if we had time, it'd be really an excellent, video for the students to see. The fact is, many people enjoy and get their history by reading historical fiction and, watching documentaries and things like that. And because it is an entertaining, painless way to learn history. I kind of enjoy doing it myself. But again, I know enough history that I can smell a rat pretty fast. And a lot of times I can tell by the scholars who they are that they're calling on for their experts, particularly when you get into the area of religion and the Bible. If they go for a lot of the more radical liberal type scholars, you're going to get one interpretation, and you know pretty well what's the program's going to be like. And most people just simply would not have the kind of knowledge to know how to evaluate what these people are saying, just like the Da Vinci Code. Most readers trust that the author of historical fiction, though, is telling them the truth about history. The historical novelist promises his readers that although the novel is about fictional characters engaged in imaginary activities, the basic historical framework is correct. That is, in a genuine historical novel. And readers trust that the author is telling the truth about history. However, as I believe it was Carl Olson who said in the Da Vinci Code, the Da Vinci Code is different. Readers of historical fiction understand the difference between known facts and imaginative details and rely on the historical reliability of the writer. However, the problem with the Da Vinci Code is that the writer presents, and I want to quote Olson here, imaginative detail in false historical assertions as facts and the fruit of serious historical research, which they simply are not, end of quote. And in this regard, Olson goes on to say, quote, Brown presents a lengthy bibliography of the works he used in the writing of the novel, all of which have a historical veneer to them, even if most of them are not real history. In the front of the book, Brown presents a list of facts contained in his novel. He states that the prior Zion and Opus Dei are both real organizations. He ends his declaration by saying, all descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. He does not explicitly include declarations about Christian origins in his list. I'm still quoting. But it is implicit in his inclusion of documents. And even more importantly, all of Brown's assertions about Christian origins are put in the mouths of his scholar characters, Langdon and Tebe in particular, who often quote from real contemporary works and frame their statements in phrases such as, historians marvel that, and fortunately for historians, and many scholars claim, I'm still quoting, these discussions function as a device for communicating the idea from Holy Blood, Holy Grail, Margaret Starbird, or who knows else, where else, to the reader, end of quote. We've already shown earlier in this series that these and other sources used by Brown are not reliable historical sources. And the last reason the novel has been so successful, go on with one other reason, and this is relativism and subjectivism.
Now this sounds so esoterical or elitism. Say specifically, what is relativism and subjectivity?
Well, they always go together. The belief that there exists no truth outside the mind leads to relativism. Relativism is the view that truth is relative and may vary from individual to individual, from group to group, or from time to time, having no objective standard outside of, you know, one's mind. An example is cultural relativism, which claims that different cultures have different but perfectly legitimate and equally valid standards of truth and value. Relativism is often just another word for subjectivism, and by subjectivism I mean an ideology or a philosophy that holds the only valid standard of judgment is that of the individual. For example, ethical subjectivism holds that individual conscience is the only appropriate standard for moral judgment.
So there's really nothing we can claim authenticity about God revealing his will, let's say, on moral law through the Ten Commandments. That's up to the person just to say, well, this makes sense to me or it doesn't. But there isn't any revealed right or wrong truth that we need to listen to God about.
And as we've stated several times in this series, Pope Benedict believes that our biggest enemy is moral relativism, the belief that something is right or wrong depending on time and place and circumstance, situation, relevance, consequence, context, and other such.
I think he used the powerful word, the dictatorship of relativism.
Yes.
Is one of the greatest dangers of our thinking today across the world.
You know, if reality is what we make of it, facts, as one scholar has put it, become nothing more than, quote, mythical constructs of an old, uptight, Eurocentric way of looking at reality. I'm still quoting. Whether out of cleverness or by accident, now, Brown has written a novel that takes a potent mixture of divergent elements and shapes them into a popular postmodern myth. Playing to the reader's biases and weaknesses, he insists history cannot be known, but he still offers a history based on fact and research. He claims that religion is a crutch, but he has written a book permeated with an esoteric, syncretistic religiosity.
Okay, you better say something about esoteric, meaning hidden.
Hidden, yes.
And syncretistic, a meshing of a lot of truths from different religions.
Yes, that's
okay.
What they mean. He implies that there's no truth. I'm quoting here. He implies that there's no truth, talking about Brown now, but he offers up secret gnosis with reality. He says that women need and deserve more attention, but only two of his main characters are women. And one of those, Mary Magdalene, is dead. He sings the praises of androgyny. And androgyny, you know, is the idea that
man and woman complete each other.
They complete each other, yes, and or the same or something of that sort.
Okay.
But he relies on the traditional formula of a handsome man meeting an attractive woman, I'm still quoting, under stressful conditions and then falling in love. He wants readers to think for themselves, but he himself relies almost exclusively on a small collection of recent books laden with conspiracy theories unsubstantiated by reputable scholarship. In a word, the novel is a mess, and its very messiness is part of its appeal, for nearly everyone can find something in it to relate to, whether it be a character, an idea, or a situation, end of quote. Then he makes his to make his point, he quotes Jean Edward Veith Jr. as saying, quote, many people find this loss of truth liberating. If we construct our own reality, then there are no limits to our freedom. In the words of a writer paraphrasing the punk rock band Johnny Rotten and the Sex Pistols, if nothing is true, everything is possible, end of quote.
Okay. All right, Ron, we're coming towards the close of the series. I want to commend you for the heroic research you've done on it that made this series possible. Any other remarks that you'd like to make before we finalize and close out the series?
Yes, there is. Carl Olson, Sandra Meisel, Meisel, I think is proper pronunciation, Mark Shea and Edward Shree, Amy Welburn and others that we've quoted, Philip Jenkins and several others, critics of the Da Vinci Code claim that it exploits people's lack of knowledge. Lack of knowledge about scripture, history, and the Catholic faith. And its so-called facts mislead them in many harmful ways. And they give at least three reasons this is true. First, it provides an ammunition to people who already have a grudge against Christianity. In other words, people who already distrust or even hate the Catholic Church and traditional Christianity are likely to find in the Da Vinci Code a lot of evidence, quote, evidence, to help justify their opposition to the Church and her teachings and to support their own erroneous views about Jesus Christ. Secondly, the Da Vinci Code provides an excuse for Christians who are uncertain about their faith for not faithfully following Jesus Christ. For instance, it encourages Christians who have not been fully living their religion to continue their lukewarm lifestyles. And three, the Da Vinci Code draws readers, even devout Christians, emotionally and intellectually into many levels of conspiracy theories in a way that is unhealthy and dangerous to their souls. Olson and others comment on how they have heard many devout Christians who have read the novel say they were deeply disturbed and their faith shaken by many of the book's ideas. Christian critics of the Da Vinci Code warn us that the conspiracy theories found in the Da Vinci Code tend to make us approach the Holy Bible, the Catholic Church, and sacred tradition with a lot of suspicion. All those questions, you know, that we've talked about on Baruch Spinoza should come to mind there. They ask, quote, do we want this kind of attitude in our hearts? Does Christ want us to have this kind of attitude? Do we want to approach Christ and the Church with a lack of trust? Do we want to come to God's Word in the Bible with many doubts about its credibility? They remind us that we shouldn't forget who was the very first conspiracy theorist of all, the devil. And from the beginning, the very beginning, he sowed the seeds of doubt in our first parents of God's love and goodness. And he wants us to doubt God's Word in the Bible and tradition, his Church, his law, and even his very existence. And since the novel is allegedly based on good research and historical fact, the conspiratorial theories found in the Da Vinci Code are as likely as not to sow seeds of doubt and distrust among Christians. Critics claim that he hopes to replace upon the ruins of the people's faith a religion of the sacred feminine and goddess worship. I want to end this discussion by quoting from one of the most thorough critics of the Da Vinci Code, Carl Olson. And he writes,
and he's gone into great research himself.
Yes. Quote, many people think they are getting a lot of facts and history from the Da Vinci Code. But in reality, many of the central points made in the book are not factual. Scholars in the fields of history, art, theology, and scripture, have noted that the book is not at all based on solid research. In fact, a number of the claims made in the Da Vinci Code are as easily disproved as claims that the earth is flat, or 2 + 2 = 5. I'm still quoting from Carl Olson. However, the average American, that is, someone who does not know much about the Bible, early Christian history, or religious symbolism, might buy into the bizarre ideas in the Da Vinci Code, because he or she does not have the background to separate the truth from the many falsehoods found in its pages. After all, how many people are experts in first century Judaism, in early Christian history, in religious art, in the Bible? So when a professional expert, quote expert, character in the Da Vinci Code starts quoting ancient documents you've never heard of, or begins spouting off scholarly theories about how there were more than 80 gospels used in the early church, or declares that Christ's marriage to Mary Magdalene is a matter of historical record, or tells you that there's no evidence in the first 3 centuries of Christians believing that Jesus is God, the reaction of the intimidated reader is, what do I know? Maybe the Da Vinci Code is right. End of quote. And, you know, many readers are not well educated in these areas, and they are, you know, easily taken for a ride. They begin to wonder whether maybe, just maybe, some of the points Brown makes in the Da Vinci Code, you know, could be true after all. And especially when the book backs up its claims by asserting that scholars and historians and educated Christians, they all know this stuff. So the average layperson does not feel informed enough to make an intelligent rebuttal. So many believe the Da Vinci Code is nothing but pseudo-history, though, because of all these reasons that I just gave. And I hope that we have offered ample proof during this series that these and other anti-Catholic claims made in the Da Vinci Code are false.
Okay, Ron. Well, we are coming to the close of our series. And again, I want to thank Michael Moroz, and has helped us produce so many of these programs for yourself, Ron, who has been such a wonderful student and doing all the research and making these programs possible. I just want to say that I've learned an awful lot in this series myself about things I've known partially or here and there, but that I've certainly have grown much deeper into a knowledge of particularly early history and early documentation, and even secular history. I think with the 2 minutes we have, if you could be good enough to say why we've spent 23 series on saying this is especially important for us to talk about and inform people about. And you've given it on several occasions, those 5 things that the Da Vinci Code had concluded, if you just sort of sort them out. And they're so devastating and anti, we would say, historical and anti-Catholic. Could you just give us those summary of what those truths are that the Da Vinci Code tries to address us about?
Well, the claims made in the Da Vinci Code, according to Carl Olson and Sandra Meisel, and of course I read the book, and that they organized the thinking on this. Jesus Christ was not truly divine, it's one of the claims made in the book, but he was merely a good man raised to the deity by the Emperor Constantine in 325 at the Council of Nicaea, and I think we refuted that rather decisively. Another claim, Jesus Christ came not to save the world from sin, but to restore the sacred feminine, which I think we spent at least 8 or 10 sessions on that, offering all kinds of evidence, I think, to refute the truth of that. Jesus Christ was married to Mary Magdalene and had children. I think we refuted that definitively. That he appointed Mary Magdalene to head the Catholic Church instead of Peter. We also, I think, refuted that. And finally, that the Catholic Church has kept those and other so-called facts hidden through force and intimidation over the centuries. I hope we laid that to rest.
Thanks, Ron, for your wonderful preparation. Michael, thank you for your wonderful electronic radio skill. A special thanks to our listeners who were with us for one session or more or even all 23. May God bless you always and in all ways.